take a minute to check your social battery. How's it doing? It's easy to ignore our needs and spread ourselves too thin. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/popcastpod today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/popcastpod.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your I Took the Walk to Midnight of Music News and Criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
You're talking for the hell of it. Addicted to betrayal, but you're relevant. You're terrified to look down. Cause if you dare, you see the glare of everyone you burn just to get there.
Karma is not for me. But apparently it's for a lot of people. It's for Karen Gans. It's for a lot of y'all who emailed in. It's round two of the Taylor Midnights Popcast Mailbag Edition. We have some esteemed Taylorologists with us today, both first-timers on Popcast. Madison Malone Kircher is here. Madison is the Bama Rush correspondent on the Styles desk at the paper. Hi, Madison.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Quinn Moreland, staff writer at Pitchfork, is here. And author and perhaps auteur of the Midnight Review is here. Quinn, what's up?
Wow, thank you for calling me an auteur.
Hell yeah. That's everybody gets their proper title.
Auteur and I got sorority rush lady.
Hey, I'm jealous.
I'm jealous too. You kidding me? You think I didn't want to be in, where was it, Tuscaloosa?
Yeah, I think I'm banned from Tuscaloosa now.
That's all right. You can fly right over. It's not a problem. We have a rather, dare I say, preposterous amount of questions about Midnight and associated topics. And we're definitely not going to get to them all. I want to thank everybody who emailed in, everybody on the Facebook group and on the Discord, everybody who cares deeply about what we might say about this. So we're just going to cut right to it. Here's the first one. It's from Yamina Hamidi, and it's just right to the point. Do you think it is time for Taylor to creatively disconnect from Jack Antonoff?
Wow, they really didn't waste any time.
Just one sentence. I want to say I got so many emails that were literally like longer than my actual review, like literal long read emails. This. What do y'all think? Quinn, kick us off.
In the past week, my heart's really opened up to Jack Antonoff, which is a radical thing for me to say, I suppose, but the guy has been suffering from some overexposure now for a while, and I thought the peak of it was going to be around solar power over the summer, last summer. Wow, he's had like a year of overexposure. Do I think Taylor should disconnect from him? I don't know. I prefer the work she did with Aaron Dessner, and I think the song on the 3 a.m. version, which I'm going to butcher, I'm sorry, would have, could have, should have.
Yeah.
I think that's a really great song. And I think Taylor is in the position right now where she could work with anyone she wants, with whatever sound she wants to go for. And I think she should open herself up to that.
Okay. Yes. I hear that. Also, Asri Dessner, groan. Asri would have, could have, should have. I think that is secretly a Lana Del Rey song. Madison, what's your vibe on this?
My thoughts are kind of the exact same feelings I had when the Chicks announced that they decided to work solely with Jack Antonoff on Gaslighter, which was a groan because this was an album I was hyped about, similarly about this Taylor album, and it's just starting to feel a little one note. I was a bigger fan of the, you know, the Dessner tracks that dropped later. I know it's cheap in pop music to liken one song to another song and say, hey, those sound a lot alike. Yeah, that's the whole genre. But hey, these are starting to sound a lot alike.
We mentioned this on the last episode, but there's that guy, the YouTube guy, and I feel bad. I'm not going to remember his name, who just like listens to 0.7 seconds of any song on Midnights and is like, yeah, Jack did that.
Guessing whether or not Jack Antonoff produced a song as quickly as possible. Yep. That's him. Yep. It might not be. No, that's him.
It's one note and it's one texture is, I think, what's really kind of kills me. The way that the vocals are treated, there's almost no variation song to song. The thing that I would say about Jack is I know he has the capacity to do a different thing. I assume this is the thing that Taylor wants and the thing that he wants to do with Taylor. They both have the capacity to do things differently, and I think they should. What do we think of the fact that they're just sneaking in work while their partners are out of town? What about that? That's odd.
Yeah. Something that I think is interesting and something that my editor Anna and I were talking about when I wrote the review is that in various interviews or conversations about like Taylor and Jack speaking individually about their work, they both keep coming back to this idea of like wanting to connect with people through their music and like that's why they make it. And so to me, it's kind of fitting that they'd be like, oh no, our partners are out of town. Let's like connect and like make music. Like that's what we do when we're feeling a little lost, I guess.
Do you think they make more music when their partners are out of town than when their partners are in town? This might be just me struggling with my own writing, but like just curious.
Yeah, my partner leaves town. I remove my pants and I order Domino's, and that's pretty much the end of it. So,
see,
yeah.
I feel like low key that. Like the idea that I'm like, there's something that I couldn't possibly get out because a person was around. Like that feels odd to me. But you know, I'm also not a very productive person. So, what are you going to do? Here's another question, which I think kind of touches on a parallel theme. This is from Aria Marsden. Aria says, after chatting with friends, I have a theory that Midnight's familiar slash old sounds and themes is actually why the quote unquote general public is responding well to the album. The same thing that is off-putting to critics is a welcome return to form for casual fans. It kind of reminds me of the nostalgia for 80s, 90s music, only Taylor is playing on nostalgia for her earlier albums. I would be really surprised if any future Taylor album outdoes the Midnight's first week commercial success for this reason, unless she continues catering to nostalgia. This is something that I probably speak about ad nauseum on podcast in regards to Drake, but I do think Taylor is guilty of this slash plays with this, where she is constantly referring her own internal mythology, both lyrically and also musically. Do you think that what might be perceived by an overthinker like myself as a reductive, like you've done this before, is actually just purely soothing candy for people who check in with Taylor, you know, once every year?
I think it absolutely is. I mean, Taylor Swift is an amazing songwriter, so I don't say this to knock her artistry at all, but I do think people, especially people my age, I'm 29, so I've like grown up listening to her music, return to her to tell them how to feel. And yeah, I think it is a little bit like candy. When I heard Karma, I was like, oh my gosh, we're doing the Bad Blood thing again. And like,
but worse.
People will be excited about that. And they clearly are. My problem is not her kind of revisiting the same themes over and over. Lots of artists do that. But it's kind of the Harry Styles situation, maybe, of like, well, are they going to go deeper? Like, how can they expand on this theme? Or these themes in a way that doesn't leave them frozen. Because Taylor Swift is growing. She's an adult. Like, she's having new experiences. She's calling herself the anti-hero.
Madison, do you think she's having new experiences?
I don't. I really think, I listen to Mastermind. I really don't. I think she's just frozen in carbonite somewhere. She looks great. But I had this feeling listening to Mastermind where I put myself in the master's head and thought, oh, she really thinks she's done something here. She thinks this is the moment where she's revealing this secret puppet master role that she's been in all these years, as though those of us who listen to her discography religiously don't already know that.
Yeah, no, it's not a revelation, not even slightly.
But I think she thinks it is. And I think that's where the frustration comes for many of us who are such diehard fans. I think that's the frustration. The middle of the Venn diagram of fans frustrated, critics frustrated is right smack in that song.
We actually have a question that's kind of a little bit in line with Quinn, what you were just talking about. This is from Cam Cuvier. Joe talked about the lyrics being vague on a few albums. And I have a theory that she's been trying to write diaristic songs, but doesn't always know how when she's not mad at or doesn't want to offend or keeps things private. I think it started on 1989 because she had nothing bad to say about Harry Styles. And the same, also the antiques meme going around this week. Very good. And the same thing with her current partner, shout out Bill Bowery. On Folkmore, she took characters and imagery to distance herself from the discourse. I agree. What do you think? P.S. I'm trying my best in English. I am French. That was well communicated in any language. Gam, thank you. I definitely agree on the Folkmore side of this. Madison, what do you think?
So my immediate thought in listening to this album the first time was, do you know those articles online you see that are like, we trained an AI robot to write a novel or to write a Taylor Swift song? It felt so much to me like all of the lyrics she's ever written had been fed into a machine and spit back out by AI in like little chunks and phonemes of pretty sounding sparkly words. Which is to say, I think this, I would agree with our question asker here that she's running.
I thought
at
you were
him.
Saying, which is to say, I loved it.
Just to say, it was great. It was just perfect. You know, the pleasure centers in my brain were going off. No, which is to say, I think she's running out of stories to tell in a literal sense. This all felt very abstracted and almost like just fractions of what we used to get.
Here's another question that I think adds a layer to this. This is from Elizabeth Lee, who says, I feel like would've, could've, should've does for Dear John, ayo, what the new lyrics of All Too Well 10-minute version do for All Too Well. Okay, so first of all, let's listen to would've, could've, should've, because we got a lot of questions about this too. Let's listen to a little bit, and then let's listen to just a few precious seconds of Dear John, perhaps the best kiss-off song in pop music history. Would've, could've, should've, if I'd only played it safe. Question continues. I listened back to the episode for All Too Well 10 Minute where you talked about, did we do an episode of that? Christ. History is long and returns to the median, apparently, where you talked about Taylor reclaiming space and re-examining an uncomfortable power dynamic as an adult. And I was wondering how you and the crew think that applies to Would've, Could've, Should've or any of the other songs on the album. So what that made me think of, and obviously there's that moment on Would've, Could've, Should've, where she says, give me back my girlhood. That was my first time. If that is indeed an extension of the Dear John narrative, maybe what she is doing is this notion of revisiting. And no, I don't have new bad experiences that I want to write about and only intermittently want to write about how much I love Bill Bowery. But go back, revise thoughts, deepen, thicken previous shots. Is that what we think she's doing here? Quinn, what do you think?
Wait, is this the song you thought was a Lana song?
Yes.
Okay, interesting.
Like spiritually, not like I don't think Lana got a check for it, but like spiritually, it is in the mode. It feels like it's in the mode.
Interesting.
Much more so than Snow on the Beach, to be frank.
I love the song. I said that in my review that I think it's one of the best songs she's ever written. Perhaps that is also because coming after all of Midnights and the first few songs on the 3 a.m. edition, it was like, whew, you know, like, here we go. Okay. Like that definitely made an impact on me. But her relationship with John Mayer, and I think so much of because of All Too Well and All Too Well, the 10-minute version, and now the VMA award-winning music video. Yeah, like all of that. It has become kind of not a spectacle, but it is like a pop culture thing. Whereas like ultimately at the end of the day, like it is this deep sense of hurt from like a young woman who was in a very vulnerable position, trusting someone. And so what I really liked about this song is that by revisiting it, I think she was kind of exploring the ways in which that sort of stuff does linger and does weigh on you and does change, especially as you get older. And I feel like what this song really does well is expand on those feelings without necessarily naming names, although she does mention like at 19, which is the Dear John connection, I suppose. But I thought this was a great song, and not only because it was again with Aaron Dessner, but it fused the like growth she made on Folklore with where she's at now, of that it is diaristic songwriting, but it's not so full of references that people are going to be like picking apart and saying like, oh, she's like talking about this. It seems like it's coming from a very intimate place.
assuming it is what we are saying it is, which is an extension of the Dear John storyline and experience, that is something that she has revisited emotionally, mentally, psychologically in subsequent years, and now is finding a new, perhaps, I don't want to say more substantive, because Dear John's a very substantive song, but a new angle, a new perspective, a new layer on how to address it in song.
Exactly. And I think that's maybe what some of the Moonlight songs were missing. They were kind of about maybe the same old ideas, but they felt like the same old ideas. They didn't feel like richer in that way.
Yeah, I completely agree. Listening to, I'm now going to butcher it also, would have, could have, should have, was so wildly affirming in a way that I, as somebody who is, you know, roughly Taylor Swift's age, has grown up with her music. The stories and the hurts we all experienced as teenagers, I feel like there's this notion that you're supposed to grow up and grow away from them and get distance and then downplay them. And what this does so beautifully, it says, I've re-examined this. I've looked back. I no longer need to put this man's name in it, though I will give you a timestamp so you still know it's about him. And I still feel this way, just smarter and wiser.
Heavy. I'm into it. Major take. I want to tie that in a little bit to the kind of like baby discourse of last week and of Twitter. Right. Okay. So first of all, a lot of people on Twitter were saying that the idea that I had put forward was my idea. It was actually not my idea. It came from a conversation between Ann Powers and Sam Sanders. I actually kind of don't agree with it, but I thought it was an interesting entry point. Where do y'all fall on the Taylor might have new things to write about if she were in a new phase of her life, particularly motherhood? Where do you guys fall on this? And I think Madison, picking up on where you just said, which is, she has plenty to write about. She has new perspectives on old events to write about. And that actually is rewarding on its own. So maybe you don't need new life experiences, or you don't need to be feeding your songwriting in that particular way. What do y'all think?
I would like an entire concept album just about her time on Cats. I don't need her to give birth. Wow. I just need to know about that.
Yeah, she really got through that unscathed, unlike James Corden.
Well, motion capture did put her in a bad light, as we say.
Can I add one thing to this particular part of the discourse, which is, first of all, I am older than everybody on this podcast. I, too, have grown up with Taylor Swift's music. We exist. Don't erase us. That's, I just want to say that. But I've been to every Taylor Swift tour, you know, since the beginning, every single one. And the thing that I am consistently, I don't want to say surprised by, but struck by, is that there are always very young girls at the tour. There are people who were young 10 years ago, presumably, and grew up and continue to go to Taylor shows. They're obviously like mothers bringing their children, but there are always young Taylor Swift fans. And I'm not saying that Taylor makes music that can be absorbed by young people specifically in some kind of like mercenary way to make sure that you always have a renewable fan base. But I do think it is striking that Taylor has, generally speaking, outside of Reputation, avoided making music that could not be accessible or relatable to someone who is arriving to pop music relatively new. And I think that is part of her broad-based success as a songwriter. It's also part of the success as a kind of like as a marketing and sales perspective. And maybe she is holding on to that idea of how to make pop music as long as is feasible. It might not be feasible at age 40 or 50 or 60, but at 32, at this stage of life, it might still be feasible to do that. And this might be the last or one of the last albums on which that's an available option to her.
The ageism argument is so sad to me. You know, I don't disagree with you, but like, that is very heartbreaking. At the same time, my therapist, when I was trying to explain to her all of the hate I've been getting, was like, wow, this is so shocking, like, you know, that Taylor Swift fans would be like this. Like, she has a maybe like 3-year-old daughter and a 5-year-old daughter. She was like, they love Taylor Swift. They sing along to her in the car all the time. And so like, yeah, she has been able to maintain this young audience in a way that is, like, I'm sure a lot of people would love to do that.
Madison, do you think she's trying to make sure that she remains accessible / relatable to even the youngest potential audience?
I know she has crafted herself, so we're supposed to believe that everything she does is a calculated decision. I think in this case, that's just her default mode. That's where the music goes when she's on autopilot. Whereas I think perhaps the Folkmore era felt like the moment where maybe you might shake off sorry.
That
younger audience, that your therapist's children perhaps are not vibing quite so hard to Champagne Problems as I was.
Please tell your therapist to not let their children grow up to be vicious Taylor stans on Twitter.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I would hope not.
Raise them right.
Yeah. She said this album was going to be about self-loathing. I wanted more self-loathing. Like, I wanted her to explore that a bit more because I think that is really interesting, especially like in this era of pop stars talking about being unhappy or mistreated in the industry, like Billie Eilish or Lorde, Demi Lovato. But I can see her kind of maybe stumbling with like how much of these more adult experiences to share for both the reason of not wanting to isolate people, but also just not even wanting to open that part of herself up fully or not knowing how.
Or maybe saving it. Maybe the thing is, and maybe the kind of midpoint between what I was proposing and what you're proposing is that maybe at some point, and I don't know what the pivot is. If it's motherhood, it's motherhood. If it's marriage, it's marriage. If it's just turning 37 or whatever, you know, who knows? But maybe she's stockpiling storylines and images and emotions for a different kind of album to be made when she doesn't have to be mindful of all age group audiences. You know, I don't know. It's certainly something that's on my mind a lot.
And also with this album, I mean, she did kind of say from the start, although I don't necessarily think she stuck to the theme very well, that it was looking back on nights. She did never really say that this was like a moving forward type album in a way.
Which is that's convenient. Ooh,
yes, I think it was a lot of choices here were very convenient.
That's what I say about some articles sometimes. I'm just like, yeah, this is definitely like not looking back. I'm looking back. I'm not, there's no new ideas in this. Don't look for a new idea, please. I beg of you.
I believe the looking back commentary the same way that I believe that every single one of those tracks on the new Red was written when she claims they were written.
You think they're all post-written?
They got a little zhuzh.
No, I'm with that. I'm totally with that. Absolutely. Let's listen to a little bit of the new lyrics from the All Too Well extended remix Boiler House version. We're going to go to a break and we'll be back momentarily.
And you were tossing me the car keys, the patriarchy, keychain on the ground. We were always skipping town. And I was thinking on the drive down.
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments. Ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Okay, before we pick the conversation back up, just something that has been on people's minds for a long time that I wanted to touch on and make a small announcement about. The email, the DMs, the Facebook messages that I get the most ask about shirts. And you know what? We made some shirts. We're going to give the money to charity. It's thepopcast.myshopify.com. They're available now. If you came to the live show, we had a few there. Also, at my closet sale, LOL. We had a few there, but we haven't put them out widely. Now they are available. Please go grab one. It's thepopcast.myshopify.com. All the profits going to the New York Times Neediest Cases Fund, which is a charity that the paper runs for more than 100 years. Incredible cause. And I'm excited to get them in your hands. And they only exist because you guys have emailed and been so generous and excited to have one. So here we are. Now back to the convo. Madison is here. Quinn is here. Taylor is here in spirit. I have a question, and I think it's picking up, actually, Madison, on something you mentioned before in regards to cats. Are you ready for it? This is from Annabelle Ostro. Annabelle says, I like Midnights, but I'm struggling to find it emotionally resonant. Me too, girl. The upbeat songs lack the specific, sometimes twee, beltability, and the rest, even in its jarring sadness that doesn't have a perspective-shifting resolution, feels anodyne. Go off.
Wow.
Yeah, right? Which leads me to my question. What would a chaotic Taylor album look like? And do we need it? Or a series of EPs where she tries new sounds in a lower risk context? So much of What's Wrong with Midnights feels like a product of the fact that she never moved past the criticism of Red as insufficiently coherent. This might have been in my review. I did not want to Google it to look, but that maybe that was me. Everything is getting flattened. What would it take to shake things up? So, chaotic Taylor album, that's not Reputation. Yes, no. What do y'all think? Madison?
I think my version of the chaos Taylor Swift album is the one where she, whether people would believe it or not, comes out at the top and says, this is the truth. I'm going to address X, Y, and Z. For example, there are, you know, these two camps of feuding stans. Never become a stan. Do not let your children grow up
say
to be stans.
Just say the words. Safe space. Say the words.
There are feuding camps of stans online, Hetlers, as in heterosexual, and Gaylers, as in duh. And they are constantly warring over whether or not Taylor Swift is encoding her messages with queer content. And in this album, the Gaylers feel that they have been victorious because it appears that Taylor is indicating the weird rumors she doesn't like are about her marriage to Joe Alwyn and not related to her sexuality. I would like an album where she just isn't cryptically liking TikTok videos vaguely about this. She just comes out, talks about it, sings about it.
Wow. Has she been liking TikToks about this?
There's one the Gaylers are taking as a big victory that has like exclusively Gaylor hashtags from like a very big Gaylor creator that Taylor liked.
Wow. I mean, it was interesting to me that she felt in her, oh my God, whatever it was called, Midnight Madness with Me, which looked like she was going mad in those videos, which I loved. But like, it is interesting to me that she felt like she needed to explain Lavender Haze. That was the only song she gave an explanation to because people thought she was acknowledging this queer phrase. And she's like, no, no, no. Like, this is about my heterosexual romance.
Building on that, though, like if Taylor did do an interview or whatever at some point and was just definitively like, I am not gay. I have never been gay. Would Gaylors hypothetically turn on her?
They should have already. She's given that interview.
Has she? In a very direct way in response to that?
As direct as she's gotten was an interview in which she said, I'm going to paraphrase, something to the effect of, I realized I could advocate for a community I'm not a part of.
Right. Yes. Okay, I remember
she
that.
She did eventually realize that. Yes.
Yes. It, brave. So brave.
There's also, of course, the video from me, one of the, of frankly, a very dismal entry in the Taylor Swift catalog that I just cannot abide. But as much as she is, you know, denying whatever the intent of Lavender is and Lavender Haze and saying I can advocate for a community I'm not a part of, then making a video like that, which is that advocacy? Like, what is that? You know, it always felt very, whatever it is, it's awkward. It's uncomfortable. It doesn't sit well. It's always felt that way. Also, like, am I crazy? Like, I generally thought, like, obviously Taylor Swift writes encoded lyrics and there are Easter eggs and so on and so forth, but I don't find her to be a kind of like hyper obscure song. Like, I do think she's fundamentally a straightforward songwriter, which is why like a song like Karma drives me nuts. Cause I'm just like, if you're going to do a concept song, like pick a good concept and be good. This isn't even a good concept. It's not even that. My feeling on the kind of like low risk EPs, and a couple people had asked variations of the question, like, if not Jack, then who? You know, like, if not Dessner, then who? And I don't know the answer to that. Like, is it Louis Bell? I don't know. Is it, I don't know, like, the people from Salt who, like, produce Adele? Like, you know, like, I don't know. The truth is there are not a lot of big tent contemporary pop music producers who work in an idiom that I think makes sense for Taylor and Taylor's voice.
All I could think of, because I figured this would be a question, was that I struggled to think of the big pop people because Jack Antonoff has been so dominating. And I mean, what, like Phineas? Like, no.
No, not Phineas, yes.
But for, in terms of, like, I think if she decided to pursue the more Aaron Dessner vibes, maybe someone like Brad Cook, who did Bon Iver and like Snail Mail's album and Waxahachie's St. Cloud, like, I don't know, someone who wouldn't make things too crazy.
Just as a sidebar, since you mentioned Bon Iver, did you guys see the live video of Exile with Taylor and Justin Vernon from the other day?
Yes.
I'm offended you had to ask.
It made my skin crawl. I struggled with it so much.
It made me suddenly very sympathetic. Have you seen that clip of Lorde performing Writer in the Dark where she's shushing the audience?
Yeah.
She really just wants to vibe. That video has always made me cringe, and watching this live performance of Exile, I was like, well, yeah, shush them. Stop. Make them stop.
make the crowd stop or make the singers stop?
Well, first make the crowd stop. And then if the performance didn't improve, the crowd could shush back. That would be fine. That's fair.
Okay. It also reminded, I mean, there's like a very early Taylor TV performance. I think it's a Grammy performance with Stevie Nicks. Am I remembering this correctly?
Oh my God. What?
Yeah.
That also, I remember, was just like a real challenging moment. And, you know, I think Taylor's fundamentally a good singer, but I feel like every now and again in the live contexts, it just doesn't quite hit in the right way. We have come to the part of the episode for the 46 questions we got about karma.
Oh, my God.
A lot of questions about karma. I want to start off with an easy one. And this is very specific. And it was not something that I had thought of, but three or four people emailed about. Does karma reference a line from CSS, which is that Brazilian group from the early 2000s, their song Music Is My Hot, Hot Sex? And in that song, there's a line that goes, music is my boyfriend, music is my da-da-da-da-da-da. That's roughly the same cadence as Karma is my boyfriend, Karma is my da-da-da. Do we think that Taylor was aware of that? Or at minimum, do we think that Jack Antonoff was aware of that?
I was resistant to writing about Karma because it is a song that initially repulsed me. I guess I've grown to be able to stand it now that it has been forced in my face on TikTok. The first time that the Pitchfork staff listened to the album, everyone was bringing up that song, the Music Is My Hot Sex.
Lawsuit TK is what you're saying.
Yeah, frankly. I mean, I forgot to mention it in my review because it's Pitchfork seems like a place where that would be like, yes, noted.
That would be the lead. That should be the lead, frankly.
Yeah. But I mean, I don't know. Maybe Taylor Swift had that on her iPod back in the day, but Jack Antonoff definitely knows that song.
Guys, she didn't watch TRL. There's no way she could have known.
Oh, stop. That's like when Miley said she never listened to Jay-Z. Come on. Okay, building on that idea, Will Schimmels has a question, which is, was Karma written with TikTok in mind? And obviously, there's been a lot of energy on TikTok in the last couple months. I somehow blessedly have been spared most of the Taylor talk or Swift talk. My algorithm said, no, not for you. Like, we are protecting you from this. I want to thank the algorithm for that. But does it specifically feel, from a songwriting perspective, to be memed on TikTok?
That's really interesting to me because, for me, the obvious pick for the song we hope will be a TikTok moment is Antihero.
And that has been the me, it's, hi, it's me, I'm the problem, it's me, has been. But Karma was more so, I think, before that even.
Was it big on TikTok? I'm embarrassed to say, I just very simply don't know.
I've seen lots of people doing their little hot dances to Karma.
So it's a dance, like it's a dance thing, or is it sketch based? Is it comedy based at all? Like, is it like storytelling based? Like, what is the meme for?
Vibing, truly. The storytelling based is Antihero. And have either of you seen the Mastermind TikToks are having a little bit of a moment?
No.
They're is that, very yeah, fun. With the how I convinced the guy to date me once?
Yeah, exactly. How Whoa. I laid a 10-year trap to convince my favorite DJ, who's now my husband, to marry me.
Unreal.
It's funny because when I was listening to Midnight, one of the first times my boyfriend walked in our apartment, I don't remember what song was playing, but that was like legitimately the exact question he asked was like, is this for TikTok? I don't know. I don't want to say that Taylor Swift is making music for TikTok, but
why? Is that any worse than making music for the radio? Like that's a genuine question.
Not anymore. Certainly not. TikTok and the radio are
same thing.
Yeah, basically.
I got a DM that simply read, karma is camp.
Yes.
Okay, wait, we're going to do the whole, we're doing the whole discourse. This is from Liana Adnam. Liana, forgive me if I'm mispronouncing your last name. And I said, LOL, tell me more. I'm listening. I don't know if I agree, but like, I'm listening. So I got a long read email, which I'll read some of. First off, if you'll indulge me, read the first three sentences, which have nothing to do with karma. Hi, this is Liana and her sister Samra. After listening to Midnight's, our immediate reaction was, we need to talk to John Caramonica. LOL. We love the podcast, even though you have horrible hot takes sometimes. Supporting reputation, derogatory, and comparing our King Harry to the devil himself, John Mayer. Okay. Both contentious moments in my background, but I stand on them. At my funeral, go up to the microphone and say, he loved reputation. He loved reputation.
Well, you peer out from the casket.
Absolutely. Literally bump it. Have like a little like iPod touch just playing it on repeat for all eternity. Anyhow, so there's that. Here's the karma section. Not only is karma camp, but it has layers. Taylor acknowledging the lost album. You have to look at karma the way you look at blank space. It's Taylor playing up the public perception of herself. Karma is the fun pop older sister of My Tears Ricochet. She is, karma is, who Reputation thinks she is. Taylor just didn't, that's great. Taylor just didn't have it in herself to go with grace. It's her reminding those who wronged her that because she kept her side of the street clean, karma is a relaxing thought. I can't top that, but have at it. Karma's camp. Yes or no?
Your DMs are so much better than mine.
Yeah.
I feel blessed. This is like it's a gift to receive messages like this. There are people who are
scholars of your writing. That is incredible.
It's truly like could not be more blessed. Like totally sincere. I'm 1000% sincere. My heart overflows when I receive messages like this.
I suppose the question that I'm curious about is, does Taylor Swift think karma is camp?
Does Taylor Swift know what camp is?
Exactly. Was she at that Met Ball?
Looking camp right in the eye. No, but you know who was?
Yes.
Jack Antonoff?
No.
Harry Styles?
No.
Tell, just say it. You're killing me.
Karlie Kloss.
Who was looking camp right in the eye. Incredible.
Also, shout out Karlie Kloss, who was IGing yesterday from the Crystal Bridges Art Museum in Bentonville, Arkansas.
Wow.
And also where Jeremy O'Harris was proposed to.
I was like, did she witness Jeremy O'Harris getting engaged?
Yeah, Jeremy O'Harris getting proposed to. Congratulations to Jeremy on getting engaged.
Shout out.
Yeah. We salute an artistic proposal. Okay.
Right
camp,
in the middle
though.
Of karma. Incredible.
It's was karma playing? Was karma playing when this happened? Okay, tell me though, does Taylor know, understand camp? And if so, is this an example of that?
See, one of the things that I like.
That's not a yes or no, Quinn.
Well, I just want to say before I give an answer, I really want her to do an interview around this album because I really want to know where her mind was at. I just would love any tidbit of explanation other than the fact that she was in that weird wood paneled room that she then like CGI'd.
Taylor Swift, come on podcast.
Yeah, great pitch, Quinn.
I think karma is camp, but really? I don't think Taylor Swift knows what camp is.
I think it's camp, but she doesn't know what camp is.
I think it is unintentionally hilarious, but maybe it was intentional. Could this song have been written around Reputation, which is like what all the theories about the album, like the video in which karma is written up on the wall with all the other album titles? Like, yeah, the song sounds dated.
Madison, what do you think?
I think it's about as camp as everything everyone wore to that 2019 Met Gala. I'm curious if the sisters in your...
Yeah.
Not very, yes. Which is to say, I'm curious if this email contains any Sontag contextualization, because I would love someone smarter than me to explain to me why this is camp. But based on my pause for admittedly limited disclosure, I don't think it is.
Same. No, there's no additional Sontagian reads here. And to be fair, I get lost in the vortex of various meanings of camp. I don't think it's camp. It goes back to what I was saying earlier about Taylor as kind of like a sincere songwriter. Even if she is a coded songwriter sometimes, I do find her to be fundamentally feels like a sincere songwriter. Like in my review, I talked about Taylor Swift versus like Taylor Swift and quote marks. To me, if she's going to be camp, it's in one of these like Taylor Swift and quote marks moments. But to me, even those don't feel like they have that additional layer on them. They don't. They still feel sincere to me.
Well, also, like, is vigilante-ish camp? Like, I don't know. Both of these songs are...
Jessica Rabbit theme song?
Yeah. Both of these songs are, in their own ways, tied to, like, her very personal vendettas against people and against the system and the way she's been treated. Like, they're not so removed that they could be truly, like, meaningless.
I'm glad you brought up vigilante-ish, because I feel like the songs where Taylor Swift thinks she's doing camp or something adjacent to it, they start with like a signpost, an arrow that says, wink, asterisk, I'm doing it here.
The cat eye, you mean? It starts with the cat eye.
I guess it literally starts with an eye this time, but yes. Broadly speaking.
But to that point, it starts with her applying a costume.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Like quite literally, it starts with her applying a costume, inviting you to see the story that she's telling as about some hypertrophied alternate version of Taylor.
And maybe that's why it's not camp, because she is going into it with that costume in the way that so many people showed up to that Met Gala wearing what they thought was camp, like screaming it. But I would prefer she moved away from that sort of songwriting, personally. I think those are fun moments on Midnights, but they were unnecessary.
Those kind of like meta moments, you mean?
I guess I just mean, I mean the run of Bejeweled, Vigilante-ish, and Karma.
I agree with you on 2 out of 3. I agree with you.
Oh, yeah. Which one is the one?
Yeah,
I like Vigilante-ish. Yeah. Like, interesting. Even if it is sort of like a little bit store brand Billie Eilish, like it's fine. There's no sense of vim, of unexpectedness. Like the person who asked about, should there be a chaotic Taylor album? It's like, I'd like to hear that. That is what Reputation was for me. And to some degree, Lover is like that. And to me, it feels regressive. Maybe when Taylor's in her full like Bob Dylan era, like on album 39, this is going to be not a worthwhile conversation to have, right? Because we'll be like, damn, album 39 really does sounding like album 36. You know, like maybe it's not going to be that important, but we are still early in her career. 10 albums is not that many albums. She's only 32 years old. So, you know, we still think of things in terms of, is there an opportunity to do something different, to take a risk, to take a step? And she has shown herself willing to take steps and risks, unexpected steps and risks in the past. So it's hard not to feel a little bit like, when that doesn't happen. And that's, at minimum, I admire Vigilante-ish for not being like the other songs on Midnights, at minimum.
That's valid. I will say I've had Bejeweled stuck in my head for several days now, so I guess it does work.
Wow.
It does serve its purpose. But mostly just the part where she says, nice. Like, is it like me part two? Ugh.
Okay, speaking of like risks, quote unquote, or options, maybe is the way to think of it. Here's a question from Garrett Clayman. Garrett, although, by the way, I bumped into Garrett, who introduced himself to me at the Flo Millie show the other night. So big ups to Garrett and his friend Ellie for saying hi. Here's Garrett's question. My question specifically is about Taylor's vocal choices on this album. I find here she is really, all caps, starting to sound like Jack Antonoff and Bleachers with her voice. While there have been glimmers of this on their other collaborations, it really sounds like she is mimicking Jack's voice on his other incredibly mid albums. Garrett, I really don't think I feel this way on Jack's other collaborations, certainly not with Lana, but even with Carly and Lorde, who share a similar vocal style to Jack. Has this been something Taylor has done with her other collaborators in the past, and I just haven't noticed? On Folklore, does she sound like Dessner? On Clean, does she sound like Imogen Heap? She has certainly lost her country twang albums ago, but how intentional was that?
That's a really good question. I personally have stayed away from Bleachers because I know it is not my thing. So I can't speak to how he sings on those songs. But I think one, you guys talked about this on the like Taylor Midnight's Proper podcast episode. I think Joe was speaking about it, her cadence and the way that her work with Jack really brings out her quote unquote like flow, if you will. And that to me was like very heavy handed on this album. And Ann Powers has written about this before. I think a lot about like her singing on Reputation. Perhaps this brings us to Midnight Rain.
Also, someone emailed me a mashup they did of Midnight Rain and Tim McGraw, suggesting that they are both about the same boy from high school, and actually made a mashup of the two. And I don't know enough about like music theory to know if everything was like in the right key and yada yada. That's a little bit over my pay grade, but fascinating idea. Shout out that person whose name is escaping me at the moment, but you know who you are.
Wow, your inbox is so much better than mine. Start sending me those emails, people. No, I think Rain is like one of those songs where like all the vocal stuff on this album is really all over the place. I think you wrote about this well in your review, John, where just a lot of it is too over the top. Like the vocal modulation is just...
The stacking is crazy.
Exhausting. Yeah. And I liked that this one, it went for it. And it went for it with what, with her natural cadence. And like, yes, it is over the top and heavy handed, like Rain, Pain. Like, okay. But in terms of her, like, Antonoff vocals, I don't know.
I can't tell if it's a singing style that's the mimicry or if it's the way the 10 vocal stems are compressed together that create the effect of the mimicry. Like, I don't think the impulse behind the question is wrong, but I can't quite tell if it's a choice of how technology functions or a choice of I went in the booth and I did this.
The stuff that Jack has produced that I really like are like Lana, Melodrama, things that are kind of a bit more freewheeling. And that I think, I forget who it was who said it, but that Taylor kind of needs like an editor.
For me, the sound that I think is missing when I think about how Taylor originally pitched this album at us about these 13 sleepless nights is there's a live version of Don't Blame Me from the Reputation Stadium Tour that goes around on TikTok a lot where she is just like raging into a microphone. And it's what? Like, it's great and it's incredibly powerful and her vocals sound amazing. And that's the pitch that I'm missing. And perhaps we can blame on Mr. Antonoff here if our listener would like. Because for me, if I'm pacing my apartment at midnight 13 days in a row, one of those days is full of that like effusive rage.
Yes.
We're coming close to the end, but I want to speed round a few questions because we have so many, but I want to speed round a few. So let's talk a little bit. First of all, let's talk about aesthetics. First thing I want to say is shout out to my guy, Ben Rayner. He's a photographer. He's a buddy of mine who basically just DM'd me to say the album cover is good. And often Taylor album covers are not that good. And so you just wanted to register that this is good. And I have to agree. I often don't like a lot of the artwork and associated visuals that come with Taylor projects. But I do think basically this is good. I don't know if it's great, but it's basically good. Building off of that, a question about the aesthetics of the rollout. This is from Sarah Elizabeth Jameson. Any thoughts on the disconnect between the visual aesthetic she presented in the lead up to the album? I thought this might end up having a 1970s singer-songwriter feel and what the album actually sounds like. I don't see much of a connection. I also thought that was a little disorienting, personally.
Aesthetically, I felt like Taylor Swift just enjoyed Severance with the rest of us, right? That was truly what I got there was, ooh, this is a good reinvention aesthetic, just purely topically.
Should she not have saved that particular reinvention aesthetic for an album more sonically aligned?
I just don't think we're ever going to get one. So, you know, put on the high-waisted pants and the nice little polos.
And also, there are no trends anymore. Everything is relevant at all moments. High-waisted, low-waisted, wide leg, skinny leg, small top, big jeans, big top, small jeans.
The generational divide was invented to sell pants, correct?
Yeah, so it's fine. I guess Taylor's just taking advantage of that. Here's a question from Sophie Rose Zucker. Many thought this would be the album where Taylor finally features true female collaborators. Instead, we got one background feature for Lana Del Rey. This album, more than any of her others, deals with gender and society's expectations for her, a topic I would imagine would lead to closer collaboration with other women. See the Phoebe Bridgers Vault track. What do you think is holding Taylor back from partnership with female artists and producers? She must be aware of the conversation online. Does she not care?
Okay, do we think that Lana had an actual verse? Was it lost in her stolen hard drive?
In the backpack? I don't know.
I want to see footage from the booth. I don't believe she's actually on it at all.
Yeah.
It does feel notional. And I think if there was ever going to be a verse, they would have redone it, you know? And also, I don't think that Lana would have recorded a verse that Taylor would not have had a bounce of, you know what I mean? So I don't think there was ever a verse, but it's sort of like, why are we doing this if not to truly mesh the two styles? You know, again, I do think this also ties into the hastiness of the record, where the concept, quote unquote, is things keeping her up at night. But also, if there is a through line, it is about how the public reckons with her, how she reckons with the public reckoning of her, which is not the same as Midnight's. And then if those are the lyrical concepts, then I agree, working with other female songwriters, female producers, and other singers would be an interesting way to get at some of these ideas. But it does not feel like a record that started with a big idea that then went and got filled in. It feels like a pile of songs that then kind of got like glommed onto a piece of vinyl.
Yes, I very much agree with that. I would like to see her feature more female musicians or voices in a way that is more than just a background harmony. I think that would be really cool, to put it, you know, lightly. She's been, quote unquote, on your own, kid, if you will, for so long. Like, inviting someone in that way would probably be like very disorienting. I'm not saying she shouldn't take that risk, but like, she has been in this mode for so long. I can understand why it wouldn't, even if the conversation is happening, that she'd maybe like hem and haw and find these like small ways to do it that are maybe ultimately like more frustrating.
That's what's baffling to me. Everyone here knows, everyone listening to the show knows, she could have made a banger with any number of those female artists. And it's the choice not to, when doing so, would eliminate, for a woman who's always trying to have less drama in her life, well, here's an easy way you could get out of it.
Yeah.
But maybe this is the chaos. Like the person who asked earlier about, should there be a chaotic Taylor EP or album? Maybe that's the chaos she needs, which is not to say it's a musical chaos. It's a chaos that disrupts the ordinary Taylor songwriting process. Maybe that's the glue that binds her best work and her worst work, is that the process remains fundamentally unaltered. Maybe we need some disruptions to the process.
The pandemic was a huge disruption to the process for her. Like, and that, to me, resulted in very great things.
Respectfully disagree, but yeah.
Yeah, I know you do.
Just, you know, just sitting here, sitting on my hands. That door. All right, last very quick questions, and then we'll take it home. David Cohen says, I know there's been talk of her Joni album, which we've talked about a lot on podcast, but I've always wondered if she'll ever do the I'm Returning to My Roots country album. Do you think events will ever transpire that will lead her to pick up the metaphorical and literal banjo again? What do you think they would be? I have a couple of thoughts on this. One is, I don't think this would happen until she's like in her 40s, when she's totally distanced from like pure pop star Taylor. I also think the genre itself, country, needs to be in a slightly different place than it has been. You know, we've lived through bro country, we've lived through gentleman country, we've lived through hip hop country. None of those centrist ideas of country music are particularly hospitable to Taylor Swift. Now, Taylor has always obviously been a one of one, existed outside of the dominant genre narrative, even when she was primarily a country singer. But I do think that making a choice to like ride back into town would feel slightly out of step with the moment. Now, there are female performers, kind of like rootsier, slightly more progressive performers that are starting to do really well in the genre. I think in the big picture, as the genre evolves, there might be a more natural entry point for Taylor to come back. That's my read on it.
I would agree with that. I wouldn't see it happening anytime soon. And I hope that if it does happen, it's not with Jack Antonoff. Like, please.
Prayers up.
Please. But yeah, I mean, I can see her maybe in the next, what was the age in the, okay, you said in her 40s. So in the next decade, maybe dabbling a bit, you know, if we ever get the Taylor collab with another female musician, maybe her and Kacey Musgraves. I don't know. That seems like really obvious.
That makes sense. I think we can smash them together. The Chaos album can also be the country album, can also be the album full of ladies, the Faith Hill collab I've been waiting for eternity.
Wow.
Just bang them all out at once.
Damn. Look, I'm into
she
it.
She says all the time that Faith Hill wrote the playbook.
Yeah.
Great. Let's pick it up and play it.
I feel absolutely like we need to connect you and Taylor and you need to like present this. She should listen to Popcast, I guess.
Yeah, I'm definitely on a blacklist, but thank you.
A blacklist on a black site being held hostage by black ops. All right, maybe we'll go out with a little bit of Faith Hill. That is our show. Thank you to Quinn Moreland. Thank you to Madison Malone-Kerger. I am grateful to have such Taylor experts here to weigh in on the most pressing questions that Midnight has put in the heads of the public. I appreciate it. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Yo, we have shirts. The shirts are in, they're in my home, frankly, and they should be in your home. The website is It's the Popcast, which is a dumb thing that I did instead of just making it The Popcast. It's the popcast.myshopify.com, and I will hand pack your order and carry it to the post office swaddled like a little child. Subscribe to Popcast. Anywhere you get your audio content, Google, Stitcher, Apple, Spotify, etc. Get in the Popcast Facebook group, tinyurl.com/popcastfacebook. Get in the Discord, tinyurl.com/popcastdiscord. Our producer, as always, is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back next week. Let's get out. Faith Hill. This kiss.
I don't want another heartbreak. I don't need another turn to cry. No, I don't want to learn the hard way. Baby, hello. Oh, no. Goodbye. But you got me like a rocket shooting straight across the sky.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know, kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.